This program contains discussions of the Holocaust and Nazi atrocities, including descriptions of the Nazi persecution and systematic killing of people with disabilities. Some listeners may find this content disturbing and may not be suitable for younger audiences. Parental discretion is advised.
This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio. Catholic Review Radio is a weekly radio program and podcast hosted by Catholic Review Media, the news operation of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic partners for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to our listeners each week.
Welcome to Catholic Review Radio. I'm Rita Bittner. Today, I'm speaking with Ilka Knuppel, author of Finding Ruth, a personal story of Hitler's secret euthanasia program, Action T4. The book is the first memoir of a euthanasia victim published in the English language, and it tells the story of Ilka's great-aunt Ruth Muehlmann, who died in Action T4, a gassing program run from 1939 to 1941 in Germany. A Maryland-certified archaeological technician, Ilka Knuppel is a graduate of UMBC who earned her master's degree in Near Eastern Archaeology from Baltimore Hebrew Institute of Towson University. Ilka has published numerous articles on archaeology and was the founding president of the Natural History Society of Maryland's Archaeology Club. I first connected with Ilka when I learned she was a parishioner at St. Joseph's in Cockeysville. I'm delighted to have Ilka with us today as we learn more about her great-aunt Ruth's story. Ilka, thanks so much for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
Thank you for having me, Rita.
Ilka, I was hoping we could start with you telling us about your great-aunt Ruth. Who was she? What was her life like? And what happened to her?
So I did not even know I had a great-aunt Ruth when I was young. My grandmother and I were very close. I called her Oma. She had emigrated from Germany. And she had told me about her brothers, one who died presumably at Stalingrad, and the others lived in what was then East Germany. But I was in my 30s and we were talking and she just happened to mention something about her sister. And I was like, a sister? You don't have a sister.
Right.
And she's like, I did. The Nazis killed her. And that's all she would say about it.
Wow.
So at that moment, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to pursue this further at one point in my life.
Yeah.
So after I raised my son, and he started going to college, and I went to college and got my master's, and I learned more of research techniques, things like that. I said, my next project is I'm going to find out what happened to my Tante Ruth.
Wow.
So I knew my aunt, Helen, Tante Helen, she helped me out a lot because she knew more about it. From her mother had told her more details.
Oh, she had heard more. Okay.
Yes. So she had heard more. She's also the one that had all the pictures that I have in the book, used with her permission and her blessing. And so Ruth was born perfectly healthy, but unfortunately at the age of 2, she contracted scarlet fever.
Mm.
She survived, but from that point on, she had some type of disability. We don't know. It was partially a mental disability.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even a learning disability, and possibly also some physical disabilities.
Oh, wow.
So when Ruth was 11 years old, her parents, she grew up with her parents. She had a younger brother who was a year younger, and then another brother who was about 7 years younger than her. She lived with her parents and her brothers in Magdeburg, Germany.
Okay.
And age 11, they sent her to Neinstedt, which was a Lutheran facility for people with disabilities.
Okay.
So she went to school there. She was going to class, and she was doing quite well by all accounts. There's letters from her father that are in the files that I found when I went over to visit, and they were very graciously made me copies of 55 documents.
Wow.
And when I first started researching this, the books were a little bit older, probably 20 years ago, and it was still kind of this, you know, the Germans just didn't want these children. They just put them in these storehouses. And I found quite the opposite to be true. You could tell from her father's letters that He would write and ask about her, ask how she was fitting in. They came to visit her as much as they could. They didn't have a car, but there was the Magdeburg Thal Railway, which is one of the oldest railways in Germany. It's a single track, and it ran from Magdeburg all the way to Thal, which is the second to last stop on the line. So they would take that to go visit Ruth. And it was during one of these visits, when Ruth was about 14, that her mother discovered that she was no longer in a class. And that could have been because age 14, they usually aged out of school. So the boys would go on to learn a trade, and the girls would go on to do either housekeeping or help with, keeping babysitting, that kind of thing.
Oh, sure.
So there's a letter where her father says, if she's not going to class, we're bringing her home.
Sure.
So in May of 1934, she came home to her family's house on Wahlbecker Strasse in Magdeburg. And almost exactly a year later, they re-enrolled her in Neustadt. And I was curious as to why they did that. And I found out when I went to visit there, and one of the employees went through with me every document. She was so gracious. She translated for me, because a lot of them were medical terminology, which I wasn't familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And they had actually started another class. So Ruth came back to Neustadt to go to class again.
Okay. And so it was an actual school, or at what point?
It was a school. It was a school. It was, they helped, and it was, I believe late, I have to look at the notes in my book. I believe the late 1800s, it was established. And it's still an active facility today, and they still serve people with disabilities.
Oh, okay. Okay. But at some point she was taken from there, how did she end up in the gassing program?
So she was at Neustadt from May of 1935, and January 27th, 1941, she was transferred to Al Schirbitz Psychiatric Hospital. Mm. This was done without her parents' knowledge and without her parents' permission. At this point, they took 300 patients and moved them to Al Schirbitz. Oh, and this
wow.
was all part of the Action T4 program, where it was kind of like a shell game, where they were moving patients around, so it would be harder to track where they were.
Uh-huh.
So Ruth was, and Al Schirbitz had one record that they had that they could share with me, but it was perfect because it showed the day she got there and it showed the day she departed, which exactly matched the institution she came from and exactly matched the institution she went to.
Oh, wow.
So she was only there for 2 months and 2 days. And then they transferred her along with 74 other women to Bernberg Psychiatric Hospital. And what the Nazis had done is they were very smart about it, evil but smart. They took an existing psychiatric institution and they took a portion of it and did the renovations there. So they have this gas chamber, little processing plant in there. And so it wasn't like a new construction somewhere that people are like, well, what are they building there? You know? So, and Bernberg, when she arrived there on March 31st with the 74 other women, they were taking off the buses and they were processed. They look at the records to make sure that the records match the patient.
Mm-hmm.
If they thought that a patient would be particularly interesting to dissect, they would mark them on their shoulder. And then they told them, of course, this was, the patients didn't realize this at the time. And they told them, they took them down the stairs into the shower room, because they were going to get a shower and then they were going to give them this big meal, is what they told them. So apparently, from other accounts and other places, most of the patients would go ahead and go into the room. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until they started jamming, they'd be 74, 75 women in this room at one time. And Bernberg has done an excellent job at preserving this place.
Wow.
The whole downstairs facility where the gas chamber was and the crematorium ovens and all that. So once they started jamming them in there, then the patients would start to resist because they started to suspect something was not right. There's two shower heads and you're going to have all these people in here.
Right.
So once they got them into the room, they would shut the door. There was an observation window,
Oh my gosh.
thick walls. So it's almost like at least a half a foot thick. And they would turn on the gas. And what they did was, these people with disabilities were basically guinea pigs for the final solution because they would
Oh
keep
my gosh.
track of how long it took them to die, how much gas did they need. So they perfected their killing technique on these innocent
Oh my
people.
goodness. So they were like the earliest victims as they
Yes, the earliest victims of National Socialism. And once they said, in Ruth's case, they said it was about 10 to 15 minutes before, well, 3 to 4 minutes to unconsciousness, 10 to 15 minutes before everybody was dead. Then they would open up the windows and the doors, air it out before they went in there. And then they'd start moving the bodies on. They either went to a room where they stacked them up in order to put them in the crematorium ovens, or they went to the dissecting room.
Oh my gosh.
Ruth, I found out, was not dissected. So that was a little bit of a good thing to
Yeah,
hear.
I bet.
And
Yeah.
given the circumstances.
Right.
And then they would just burn them one after another in the crematorium ovens.
Oh my gosh. It's just I feel like it's horrific to hear for your average reader, your average listener, but for you as her great niece, even though you didn't know of her or did for a while and didn't know her intimately, it must still bring up different emotions for you. Like, what was it like to dig into Ruth's past and learn more about someone who's so connected to your family story?
Well, I feel like I've really gotten to know her through, the stories that my aunt has told me, and I've been around people in my husband's family that had disabilities. So you're talking about very vulnerable young lady. So she was only 20 years old. She hadn't even turned 21. To be so systematically and coldly killed, I think that was the hardest part to understand.
Yeah.
I understand crimes of passion. You walk in, you find your husband in bed with somebody, and you're like, oh, I'm going to kill you kind of thing. But this was, how do we save money? How do we get rid of these useless eaters that don't contribute to society?
Right.
And they did studies. They were like, if we get rid of X amount of people, we'll save X amount of money.
Oh my
And they
goodness.
actually had a formula that came up. It was 10,000 to 10 to 5 to 1. So they figured out of every 1,000 German citizens, 10 of them had some kind of disability. Of those, 5 were institutionalized. And they figured if they killed one out of every 5, then they would save this amount of Reichsmarks
Oh
every
my
year.
goodness. So entirely not no regard for human life in that
No,
way,
none
for the
whatsoever.
individual. Our guest today is Ilka Knoepel, author of Finding Ruth, a personal story of Hitler's secret euthanasia program, Action T4. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. Remembering her joyful faith journey and reminding congregants of her miraculous healing through the intercession of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, Baltimore Archbishop William E. Lurie offered the funeral mass of Ann Teresa O'Neill, July 25th in Emmitsburg. About 200 people, including several Daughters of Charity, attended the mass at the Basilica of the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. O'Neill, a Baltimore native whose extraordinary healing from cancer as a child contributed to the canonization of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, was a longtime Saints Peter and Paul parishioner in Easton on the Eastern Shore. She died at age 78, July 17th. At 15, O'Neill attended Mother Seton's beatification, over which St. Pope John XXIII presided in 1963. She was a 27-year-old mother of four when she witnessed the canonization of Mother Seton in 1975, over which St. Pope Paul VI presided. For more on this and other stories, visit CatholicReview.org. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, I'm George Matisek.
Remember the spirit of your parish community, the power of worshiping together, the warmth of friends new and old who share your faith. Join us for Mass this weekend. Visit archbell.org to find a Catholic parish near you. Feel the joy.
This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Review Radio. I'm Rita Bittner, and we're talking today with Ilka Knuppel, author of Finding Ruth, a personal story of Hitler's secret euthanasia program, Action T4. We're discussing the memoir Ilka wrote about her great-aunt Ruth, who died at the hands of the Nazis as a young woman. Ilka, as you were researching your book, you mentioned going to Germany. I'd love to hear, how many trips did you take to Germany? Where did you find your information? And just how difficult was it for you to track down some of the info about your great aunt Ruth, her life and her death?
That's a very interesting question, because, of course, when I first started out, I have a good friend, Will Prunka, and he was a World War II historian. So Will and I traveled to Germany twice so that we could actually go and visit places where Ruth had been. And the very first thing I did was, of course, turn to Google.
Sure.
Try to Google some of this stuff. Nothing was online. Absolutely nothing. And we found I would email the facilities, and probably because it's, you know, in between countries, there wasn't much response to that. I got better responses if I wrote them letters. But it got to the point where I was like, you know what? I think I just need to go there in person, see people, talk to the people that are there. And that's really when we started finding some information. It was also because all the facilities were in East Germany. So even since when I started this, there's a lot more online now. They're digitizing things and putting them online. There's also a privacy issue, because in the United States, generally, your right to privacy ends upon your death. Well, in Germany, it lasts for 80 years. So some of this documentation, I had to prove that I was related to her. And fortunately, I had like my grandparents' marriage certificate, and then they could see that, you know, my grandmother was her sister and that type of thing. The first time we went was in January of 2020. And we were actually at in Bernburg, staying at this kind of nice little B&B place. And we were watching American or the news in English, and they kept referring to Wuhan, China. And at the time, I worked for FDA, and I looked at Will and said, we need to go home because they're going to close the borders because this is bad.
You could tell. Oh, right. With that expertise.
So, ironically. Both times we went, we found people very receptive and willing to talk to us at these institutions. There's much more willingness in German society now to talk about these things. I think the older generation, there was this feeling of collective guilt that kept people from talking about what had happened with the Nazis. And also a lot of the families didn't know what happened to their family members that died in Action T4. When my father and aunt had gone in 2011 to visit Germany, they actually met Ruth's brother's daughter. So that's their first cousin.
Okay.
They met her in person, and she didn't even know that Ruth existed. Her brother had not told her.
Wow.
So it was guilt and shame and just, you know, various reasons why they didn't talk about these people anymore. But it's, the information is much more forthcoming now.
Yeah. Guilt and shame about how she died or about her disabilities while she was alive?
I think mostly about her disabilities, because, of course, you know, during the Nazi realm, it was the Aryan race. You didn't want to have somebody in your family that had any kind of imperfection, because that could reflect then upon you. Do you have something wrong with you? Are you a useless eater? So I think it was partly that. And the other part was just the more collective guilt of what had happened in Germany during World War II.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I think we all wrestle with the evil acts that happened during this era leading up to and during the Holocaust. And, you know, we want to believe people are good and want good for others. And I know you are a person of faith. I'd love to hear maybe how your faith helps you as you reflect on this time in history, and or maybe just as you reflect on Ruth's life specifically. Like, how does that help you carry forward?
That's a good question. I definitely felt that God was with me in this journey, because it was to find out what happened to Ruth was really like finding a needle in a haystack. Our family did not know what happened for 78 years. The oral tradition was that Ruth died due to a bad reaction to a flu shot. So basically anaphylactic shock. And what the Nazis had done is they had this whole system set up. They had 61 unverifiable causes of death. So they would put that in the letter to the families. We do not have the letter that my great grandparents would have received, but there are examples in the Bundesarchive of letters that were sent down, and they were form letters. So you knew exactly the type of letter that they had received. I also felt I had to take several times. I had to take a couple weeks or months off because it was such a heavy, heavy feeling dealing with this evil and how could, you know, God permit this to happen.
Right.
So I struggled with that, but I actually have a tattoo that I got for Ruth, and it is a Fiat Lux, and that is Latin for let there be light. So I think that, you know, God saved all these people. You know, I think they're in heaven now and they don't have any more troubles. But it was a very heavy, distinctly evil thing to research and to deal with. And people have told me when they've read the book, they're like, this was a really heavy read. And I agree. But I also think it's very, very important to know what happened in the past and to know that, you know, regimes and governments can do this to people and that we need to let our light shine, do what we can to resist and to protect our family and our fellow people.
I love the tattoo. I love that sense of let there be light. That's a really beautiful way to think of it. And the book, it's heavy material. I loved how you incorporate photos into it, and it makes it so much more personal. But it's so important to remember that these are people who lived lives just like us. And really makes it feels a little bit like a family story because you're telling it from the family side. And so I thought it was beautifully done, as heavy and as difficult as this is to wrestle with. It's such important work that you've done. So thank you for working on this. Do you feel especially connected to Ruth? You know, do you think about what it'll be like when you meet her one day in heaven? But, you know, and does your faith help you feel more connected to her?
Yes, it does. And I felt her presence distinctly when we went to Bernburg and they gave us a tour of the facility. That's when I found out what actually happened to the ashes. Other of the killing centers would dump the ashes into a nearby river. And the River Saale is very close to where the Bernburg facility is. And I assume that's what they did. They had dumped the ashes in the river. But while we were there, one of the employees told me, said, no, several years ago, an older gentleman who had worked there during this time came forward and said that he was the one that would drive the horse and the wagon with the ashes in the back of the wagon. And they took him down to the trash midden on the edge of the property of the Bernburg facility. So these ashes got dumped in with all the other hospital waste. So when I found it out that day, I said, and they knew the approximate location, not the, you know, exact perimeters of it. So I said, I wanted to go. So Will and I went down there several days later when I was able to process it. And I got out of the car and there's a soccer field there. And they built this cute little German community there with the little houses and the beautiful lace curtains in there, very peaceful cobblestone streets. Got out of the car and there's a hedgerow that runs along the soccer field. And this was January 2020. Yeah. And there was forsythia blooming, which is, that part of Germany is kind of similar to the Maryland climate. So it's kind of early for forsythia to be blooming. And I walked towards the hedgerow, and it's never happened to be before or since, but I had this feeling of peace just descend upon me. And I knew it with Ruth, and I knew she was finally at peace because she's like, my family finally knows where I am. And since then, I've felt very connected to her. And I think, when I pass over, I think she'll be one of the first people there that I'll get to meet. I'm hoping.
Yeah, I bet she's waiting for you. And you know her story as well as anyone on earth. And so how amazing to think of what that reunion will be like. What lessons are you hoping people will take away from reading the book?
Unfortunately, I think because as I was doing the research, I'm like, how could this ever happen? How could we ever do this to people? And there are, I believe, very similar things happening now in the United States with the immigrants and elsewhere in the world. So it's history does repeat itself. So I think that's a very important lesson to learn.
For us always to be on alert and protecting human life
Yes.
and all of that, that's an important lesson. Well, thank you, Ilka Knuppel, for being with us today to share about your research and writing and to help us learn more about your great aunt Ruth's story. Listeners, you can learn more on Ilka's Instagram account, Finding Ruth 1941. For Catholic Review Radio, I'm Rita Bittner. Thanks for listening.
The Catholic Review is the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the Catholic Church full time. Pick up the monthly magazine at your parish or have it delivered to your home. Subscribe to our e-newsletter for twice weekly updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Read it today in print or online at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Tune in to Catholic Review Radio next week. Available on WMET 1160 AM and 103.1 FM, and also WSJF 92.7 FM in the Sykesville area. Check us out at catholicreview.org/cr-radio. Also on Apple Podcasts, Alexa, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Review Radio. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May Almighty God bless us and keep us always in his love.